everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's August 2019, and you're listening to episode 137, How We Lost the Universities and How to Reclaim the Voice of Christ. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Corey Miller. Corey is president and CEO of Ratio Christi, which is an apologetics evangelism ministry on more than 180 college campuses. And he is also the co-author of Leaving Mormonism, Why Four Scholars Changed Their Minds. Corey has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called How We Lost the Universities and How to Reclaim the Voice of Christ. It's free online for you to read at equip.org. Corey, it's good to have you on.
Hey, it's great to be here, Melanie. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Sure. Well, now, within Christian circles, I think this is a big issue that people talk about, especially if some parents are listening and they've gone through the application process to universities in the United States, or they're about to go through the process because it's August and that kind of starts up at the end of the month for the fall. But some people are concerned that a lot of universities are, you know, hostile to Christianity and maybe would not be a good place for their student to study. So it's always a very big issue. So why does it matter to you when you think about this article that you wrote, that what do you mean by we lost universities? You seem to assign, you know, pretty big importance to this claim. What does that exactly mean in terms of Christianity?
Yeah, well, the thinker Richard Weaver once said that ideas have consequences. And we hear the statement, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. But that is not the case in the universities. What happens in the universities has a way of making its way into pop culture. Eventually, it's the gatekeeper of thought in a culture. So, you know, Hitler said, give me the textbooks and I will control Germany. And he did. Abraham Lincoln said that the philosophy in the schoolroom in one generation is the philosophy of government in the next, and he was right. I think the universities, Melanie, are the most influential institution of Western civilization. It's from them that we get our doctors, our lawyers, our business leaders, our future political leaders, our artists, our K-12 educators, and even our future professors. As goes the university, so goes the culture, and at least at this point in history, as goes the U.S. university, so goes the world.
So, you know, just in your title that we lost the universities, you're claiming that we quote unquote lost something and it assumes something that we were losing. But to what extent have we ever had, you know, universities that we've lost in terms of Christian worldview?
Right. I think you can look back, say at the very beginning, even if we want to dispute the notion that America was a Christian nation, I don't think it necessarily was. You don't find in the founding documents quoting Jesus on anything. It talks about the Creator, talks about inalienable rights. It gives lip service to that direction. And you can tell, even though it's a theistic nation rather than an atheistic nation, there was a bit of deism in that as well. Most of them were theists, and the vast majority of those were Christian theists. You didn't have Muslim theists, for example, or very many Jewish theists in the founding of this country. So even though it's not a distinctly Christian nation, it certainly is colored Christian, and it definitely was theistic as opposed to atheistic or pantheistic, those three being the all-inclusive set of mutually exclusive worldviews. And so when we think about how it started, you know, in 1636, more than 100 years before the nation began, the Puritans arrived, and within a few years, they launched the first college. It was called Harvard, and the motto was Veritas, which means truth. And that Veritas was in Latin capital V or English capital T for truth, because for them, all truth was God's truth. And Harvard, as an example, set the tone. It required chapel attendance. It required its freshmen to take Hebrew. Quickly, its mission statement was modified from veritas simply to become veritas Christo et Ecclesia, or truth for Christ and the church. And it maintained that motto for almost 300 years until 1936 on its 300-year anniversary. And at that time, they got rid of it, and I would say they kept the little V, veritas. But for the longest time, the vast majority, and later maybe we'll give some examples, of the universities in America, both before and after the Revolution and the Civil War, were not just theistic, they were Christocentric, they were Christ-centered. By, you know, Harvard, 50% of its graduates became clergy. And by the 1840s, considering all the colleges in America, one-third of university presidents were clergy. That is not the case today. We have lost what we once had.
You know, you don't directly mention this in your article, but you seem to imply in it that, you know, there's maybe some kind of intrinsic connection between Christianity that would even cause the creation of the university. But as people think of Christianity, they just sometimes think that's just reducible to their own personal faith. I mean, what about Christianity itself would cause the founding of universities at all?
I think in some respect, Christian thinkers have been part of the problem in this, or at least Christian communicators, talking about faith juxtaposed to knowledge. The expression, a leap of faith, was done by Soren Kierkegaard, a Christian thinker. And a lot of people think of the Christian religion as a religion of faith, but it's not. It never was. It was always part of a knowledge tradition. You go back to the very beginning, the foundation of Christianity, which is Christ himself. In John 17, he says, "Here then is eternal life, to know God." That's the purpose of life, centers around knowledge, knowledge of the greatest reality of God, but knowledge nonetheless. And in John 1:1, in the biblical text, the author is, you know, he's speaking using Greek, but he's speaking to a Jewish audience who understands the "in the beginning" expression. John could have used the Greek word rhema, but instead he used the word logos, which we translate to our word logic. And so John, in the purpose of the book, was trying to get people to believe in Christ, and he's thinking about Gentiles as well. Logos was very central in Greek thought at the time. And so John is doing double duty, communicating both to a Greek and a Hebrew audience when he says, "Anarche en ha logos, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and it was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us." So from the very inception, part of the DNA of Christianity is logic. It's equally true to say of God, God is love, as it is to say God is logic. God is the basis not only for morality in the Christian viewpoint, but also for rationality itself. So a lot of secularists want to say that, you know, university life, that's where the big boys play. If you're going to bring faith into it, please stay at home or stay in your closet. But this is where the big boys, the scientists and the people concerned with facts and knowledge belong. But it wasn't the secularists who created the universities. It was the Christians. And it's not just an accident of history that this happened. It happens to be in our DNA. And so you find, as a matter of fact in history, that the universities did not emerge in pantheistic, where all is mind, in the East. They didn't emerge in a materialistic world either, where all is matter. They emerged in a world where mind created matter and gave us rational senses to be able to map on empirically to the external world and be able to abstract things and then make induction and deduction from that. And those universities that first began in, you know, in Europe, from Bologna and Paris and Cambridge and Oxford, all of them were Christian. And that exported to America, beginning with Harvard. And then from the American project on, it went to India and South Korea and other places around the world. A lot of people think that Christianity reduces to faith, but it doesn't. It's a knowledge tradition. The word faith is trust. Trust in what? Something that's trustworthy. It is a reasonable faith. And this also explains why the majority of the, at least the fountainheads of the sciences, were all theists or Christian theists in particular, from, you know, Kepler in astronomy to Newton in physics, Pascal, Linnaeus in taxonomy, Maxwell, Robert Boyle in chemistry, the father of, you know, modern genetics, Mendel in his monastery is playing with pea pods. Virtually all of them, science did not arise in the East. It arose in the Christian medieval Europe and went on from there.
You know, that's an interesting observation about that, because you think about today, how many students, international students, come from the East to study at American and Western universities, because it's very different from their own educational systems. And it's those kinds of things where we've developed critical thinking that in other cultures, in their education systems, they don't have that. And that's where a lot of creativity does come out. Our family hosted an international student for a couple of years, and it was very different for that student to come and study at a Christian school, because in their country, in Asia, they just do sheer memorization. It's very hard for them. They don't think critically. They've never been thought to have innovative thoughts. So that's kind of an interesting thought about how the rise came out of the West of these kinds of universities. You know, in one of your sections of your article, you title it Extreme Mission Drift. So can you give us kind of a big picture of what you mean by this, and maybe some other examples besides Harvard, because that was a very interesting example that maybe some of our listeners might not have known about the roots of Harvard.
Right. There is a book that I took our board through of Rocio Christi and some of our senior staff called Mission Drift by Peter Greer. And in that, he talks about, you know, the crisis facing leaders, charities, and churches in general. And the point is that mission drift happens quite automatically. It's, you know, it's the norm rather than the exception. He mentions Harvard in here, but I would go on and really look at the entire education system in America and virtually mostly all of the universities, especially those before the major crisis that hit. And in that, you can see, you know, not just Harvard with Veritas in 1636, but Yale came online in 1701. Again, that's before the country even became the United States of America. And what happened was that, you know, innovative businessmen and some of the conservative thinkers from Harvard, the faculty, realized that Harvard had begun to drift. And so they said, let's start this project again. We're going to go over to Yale, and we'll call it Lux et Veritas, or Light and Truth. Why light? Because that symbolizes the Hebrew notion of salvation. And so Yale began with light and truth. And I was at Yale not long ago, and I was looking at the archway going into the campus, and it still says to this day, for God, for country, and for Yale. Well, now today you have sex week that happens at Yale, where maybe a feminist professor may get up in the buff and, you know, hear me roar. Harvard, of course, you now have people like Steven Pinker writing The Apologetic that became Bill Gates' new favorite book, Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. And there's even a professor there who has been on the edge of almost endorsing some quasi version of pedophilism. And then you have Princeton, again, 1746, still the country hadn't been founded, and its motto is, under God she flourishes, Vet Nov Testamentum, Old and New Testament. I was also at Princeton looking at its shield. And one of its first presidents was a graduate of Yale, Jonathan Edwards, one of the most famous theologians in America. And then you get to Columbia University, 1774, first college in New York, but fourth in the United States, and again, just before the country was even founded. I was walking around the campus there, just looking at the architecture, and I saw Psalm 36:9, by thy light we shall see light. And today, I couldn't tell you the number of crazy professors we have there. And so we have moved radically from sacred institutes almost all of which their primary purpose was to raise up missionaries and pastors to begin with, who were viewed as some of the most intelligent people in culture back in the day, to now what we have are secular universities, where if you're going to be a Christian at all, you'd better keep your mouth closed. Otherwise, you might not get good grades, you might not get tenure, you might not graduate with your PhD, which was my story. It is now a fully secularized university and swallowing up the next generation rather quickly, and can be explained as why our culture is going so secular so quickly.
Well, the university that I went to, the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, it was founded in the 1800s. I don't know if it was founded at any Christian foundation. I don't think so. But by the time I got there a couple decades ago, you know, in one of my classes, we did a whole entire section in a women's studies class. You know, the section was God is dead. So every day that they came in to talk to us about, you know, why God and Christianity had died, why it didn't matter, what does that, you know, now this new revelation that we have where, you know, we're the center of everything. And of course, that was kind of early roots of the whole LGBTQ movement as I took that class. So all of that is very fascinating with those different colleges. You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Corey Miller, and he has written an online exclusive article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's free online at our website, equip.org, and it's called How We Lost the Universities and How to Reclaim the Voice of Christ. I'd also like to invite you to subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. You can do that by going to our website, equip.org, and a subscription is $33.50. And when you subscribe to the journal, you join our team of print subscribers whose paid subscriptions help provide resources so that all these articles and this podcast, Postmodern Realities, can be free to you online as well as free to people that we're ministering to worldwide. And if you're already a subscriber, or right now a subscription is not in your budget, another way you can keep supporting our website and our journal and this podcast is to leave us a tip. And a tip is just a small amount, maybe $3, $5, which is the cost for some people of a latte or a lunch out or a coffee drink of some kind, or even maybe $10 or $15, which would be the equivalent of maybe a monthly subscription to your favorite online streaming service where you watch TV shows or movies. You can leave us a tip by going to this podcast episode through our website. You go to the magazine tab, you do the drop down menu, you go to PMR podcast, you find this episode, and there we have a link where you can leave us a tip. And we are really grateful for all of your support to help us continue to bring you all these apologetic resources. Well, we were just talking a little bit ago, just kind of more in broad strokes about this whole issue, but getting more specific, what were some of the major issues that moved these universities that had religious or some sacred or theological foundation, or even maybe sectarian institutions, to become what we know as the secular, quote, modern university? Was there some kind of movement by atheists through that launched this, or was it something else?
One might think that there was a conspiracy with Richard Dawkins that, you know, he pre-existed and took over the universities, but that didn't happen. You know, to give you a sense of how secular the modern universities are now, and then to go back and look at that, you know, the faculty ratio from, you might say, from liberal to conservative thinkers, and that's a broad term, but just based on that alone, it was 2-1 back in the early 90s. It's moved quickly, then to 4-1 in the mid-90s, 12-1 now for, you know, professors who are age 65 and older getting ready to retire, and for younger scholars coming in, 23-1 in some departments like religion departments. God forbid a parent should want to send their child to a religious studies department. It's 70-1. If that doesn't show what's been happening in the universities and how it's not a place of viewpoint diversity, and it certainly isn't looking at things from a Christian outlook, it is very, very much secularized. I think some of the major issues that precipitated this was the move into modernity. And, you know, major issues were during the Enlightenment period. Recall that our country was founded 1776. You might look at the Enlightenment project beginning with Descartes in 1650 to maybe 1850, maybe 1900, something like that. During that period, you end up having ideological, methodological, and practical things taking place. Ideological things, you end up with the rise of biblical criticism happening, the JEPD theory, the questioning of Genesis, the rise in 1859, you know, of biological evolution with Darwin's theory, and, you know, the replacement of Darwin in biology from, say, teleology that was embraced by the Greeks all the way up through the medievals, both Jewish, Islamic, and Christian thinkers. And so now design is no longer a factor. You're not thinking about giving a formal or a final cause, a teleological cause, a purpose behind things. Now things are without purpose, and you're explaining everything by materialistic causes. Second was the methodological issue that was happening at the time, and that is the rise of research, of science research. Now, note that, you know, as I said, the fountainheads of all the major sciences were Christians, but coming from Germany in particular, you know, someone once said in the Bible, does anything good come from Galilee? Someone else has said, after Luther, has anything ever good come from Germany? And this is where, you know, the Enlightenment period ended and culminated with Immanuel Kant, who we can remember in history for "You Can't Know Ultimate Reality." You know, he questioned all of natural theology. His views affected science as well. But we, on the rise was this view of not just science per se, which in Latin was scientia. The medievals used to talk about, you know, scientia was at the fountainhead of the university. Theology is the queen of all the sciences, by which it meant the knowledge disciplines. Scientia in Latin is the equivalent of episteme in Greek, or epistemology, theory of knowledge. And so it wasn't just what we think science is today, which is reducible to chemistry and physics. Science meant all of the academic disciplines back then. Well, what's happening in the Enlightenment was you're now cutting off the era of pre-modernism, where there was design, where there was metaphysics, where there was religion, there was God, there was a non-materialistic world, and now everything started to move into the materialistic era. The father of modern science, Francis Bacon, used to talk about the two books of God, the book of nature and the book of scripture, and said that the two could never contradict. But since Bacon and going into the Enlightenment and past the Enlightenment, these new research methodologies were trying to focus without any sectarian influence. They didn't want the Lutherans. They didn't want the Presbyterians. They didn't want the Baptists. They wanted it to be purely based on human reason and reason alone. And what won the day in the Enlightenment was a particular form of reason. It was scientific reasoning that you could test with the five senses. And so with that research methodology rose scientism that maybe we'll talk about a little bit later. Well, what happened with that, Melanie, was that at this time in the United States, it was almost unheard of to think of a top scholar in the field at a university who had not gone over to Germany and studied. And this influence gets taken overseas and gets brought back. And the new way of thinking, the new research way of thinking from a scientistic point of view, not a scientific point of view, started to take root. And it was almost like what we would call methodological naturalism today, methodological scientism, where you can be a metaphysical theist, that is someone who believes that there is a God, but you're going to practice a methodological naturalism. You try to explain all the data by invoking all and only natural explanations. Well, of course, you're never going to get intelligent design theory out of that because you've already ruled it out. You've got to have a natural explanation. So that was one of the methodologies that got exported. And then finally, you know, there was the rise, not just in the sciences as a focus, but also in technology and pragmatic concerns that as the country was growing and new colleges were emerging, practical needs were also emerging. You wanted to train people in technology. You wanted to give people opportunities for other jobs than just, say, becoming clergy or something like that. And any sectarian school that was just focused on the sacred was finding itself uncompetitive with the free market audience. And so it started offering graduate schools, professional schools focused on the science, where the science now had this new methodology and this new worldview going into it. And George Marston writes about this in his book, The Soul of the American University, From Protestant Establishment to Established Non-Belief. The vast majority of all the universities for the first couple hundred years were Protestant, but somehow they got dominated by a modernist, or equivalent with that, a liberal Protestant theological perspective. And eventually that took root, and ideas have consequences, and the rest was history.
There's a section of your article where you title it, The Die is Cast, and you point to a certain time period where there are various factors that would cause like this huge change in university. So can you discuss the importance of that particular time period?
Yes. And along with what we were just saying, you know, some of the theological distinctions of a sectarian school limited to, say, the Presbyterians or the Congregationalists or whatever, limited a college's constituency becoming a liability. So the colleges started to emphasize the unifying aspects of the Christian religion, which ended up being morality rather than some distinct theology. And at the time, theology was being reduced to anthropology and to morality. Some of the Enlightenment thinkers saw the Bible, especially through the lens of biblical criticism, and said that the value, the redeeming value of the Bible really is not its historicity, but its morality. And so you're thinking at the same time, you know, with the rise of deism and liberal theological thinking. By liberalism, I'm not thinking politically, I'm thinking theologically. And so by the time you reach the 50-year critical period, which was post-Civil War, 1880 to 1930, that was really the critical period. You had several commitments that I just discussed that were already at bay. They were already precipitating cataclysmic changes that would end up taking place between that 50-year period. The debates were happening at Yale, at Princeton, at Harvard. But when you consider those particular areas, how those ideas eventually fleshed themselves out during the 1880 to 1930 time period, with respect to religion, the defining feature was that you were no longer looking at universities or colleges to train clergy. People were being trained in other professions, and ministerial education now shifted essentially to divinity schools. And so rather than just Princeton University, you have Princeton Theological Seminary, for example. And so it allowed the colleges to focus more practically on secular as opposed to sectarian. Second, during that time period, again, the Enlightenment thinking was variously exported from Europe. The reverence for scientific authority had taken itself to new heights, and it no longer was simply science, which emerged in Christian thought, but it was now scientism. And the corollary was that moral philosophy had begun to replace theology. This is why you have some talk in Christian circles about the social gospel that happened over a century ago, that things are getting better and better every way and in every day, and that Christianity is virtually equivalent with morality, with moralism. And so that became the defining feature for the intellectual life of the Christian in the universities. And then third, again, to serve the public in very practical ways, was a free market economy where they had their new graduate schools, focus on technology. They had to meet the needs of the community around them and professional schools, all of which took a decidedly secular approach. And so through the latter half of the 19th century then, the German universities served as America's graduate schools before we got our own. And so all of our big scholars were going over to Germany. And think about this, Melanie, behind every PhD is a doctorate of philosophy, whether that's a PhD in physics or history or basket weaving. At the highest level, everyone's doing philosophy. And you're either doing theistic philosophy or non-theistic philosophy. And given what was coming out of Germany, that started to influence all the scholars that were coming over here. And by the 1880s to 1930s, the leaders that had managed to take a step into the significant roles in the universities were already making their way thoroughly through the system. And this German philosophy and secular research methodology was just enormously influential. And I think it came out in two ways. After Immanuel Kant, you end up getting either empiricism, scientism, not just empirical investigation in science, but empiricism, the be-all, end-all of knowledge, that unless you can verify it with one of the five senses, it can't be an item of knowledge, which is self-defeating, but it lasted for at least 50 to 60 years. And out of the other area in the humanities, you ended up getting an idealism, a real subjective approach to truth that was given more and more validity, so that absolute truth was going away. Biblical criticism was on the rise, and the trend again was to reduce religion to morality and theology to anthropology.
So what has happened to truth since kind of that huge shift, that big cataclysmic change in the university? And you talked at the very beginning about ideas having consequences. I mean, given that shift so many, almost 100 years ago, I guess, you know, what does that look like now, especially because you oversee a ministry that works on the college campus? What is the current climate?
The current climate is very, very difficult if you're going to be an outspoken Christian, because, you know, about a century ago, we abdicated our role and responsibility in high culture. D.L. Moody went through Yale, and he thought Yale was on the rise, but there were severe problems he was not aware of. And Moody made this statement, don't polish the brass on a sinking ship. In other words, don't think long term, think short term. The Titanic's going down, just get the souls off. And so we took our eyes off of thinking long term strategically, like the universities and government and media and arts, and focused instead on crusade after crusade after crusade and getting souls saved. We were locked out, as it were, out of the universities, even now out of those divinity schools that had started, the Princeton Theological Seminary, for example. The conservative theologians were pushed out of there and had to go start Westminster and other schools. And so during that time of the what we'd call the fundamentalist modernist controversy, you had to retreat back into the seminaries, but even those first-line seminaries were now being hit. But by the end of the 1930s, the shift had radically already taken place, and now Christians were pretty much on the outside trying to get in. But another good book for your listeners to consider is The Making of the Modern University. A Yale scholar talks about the intellectual transformation and marginalization of morality. And again, this goes back to the German philosophical influence, where Immanuel Kant split fact from value, faith from reason, faith from science, and so forth. And so that every academic department these days wants to call itself a science, the science of economics, the Department of Psychological Sciences, or something like that. There is fact and there is value. And so the scientism that was dominating decades later, and I mean a lot of decades later, we saw the rise of neo-atheism. And if you think about it, most of these neo-atheists, they were like Richard Dawkins. They were scientific naturalists. Well, the university departments had been split in two for quite some time. You had the scientific naturalists, we think about atheism there, typically in the natural sciences, chemistry and physics and biology. But in the humanities, what was going on there? Well, they were getting less and less prestige, but something was happening. From the German philosophy, from Immanuel Kant, and the subjectivity of knowledge, things were happening there. In 1933, something significant happened. You had Marxism had failed after World War I. The Marxist thinkers that were influenced from that stream of idealism and from Immanuel Kant in a secularist fashion, they had realized that the workers of the world did not unite. They did not come and throw off the bourgeois. And so they started asking questions, what can we do? And they developed this critical theory, not critical thinking, but this school of critical theory in Frankfurt, Germany, again, 1933. Well, the Nazis came to power. And as you know, the Nazis are national socialists, but Marxists are global socialists. And they're not really friendly with one another apart from the socialist aspect. And so they had to get out of town. Where did they go? They moved to the East Coast in America, embedded in Columbia University and some of the Ivy Leagues. And as this stuff works its way through systems in the universities, sometimes it takes a long time to turn a battleship. They wrote very, very influential books, and these books took root in the humanities departments across the board. They became influential. And by the time you get to the 60s and the sexual revolution and a postmodern context now, you're now seeing the demise of modernity and the rise of postmodernity. And the only way, you know, people think about postmodernism is kind of relativism. Modernism used to say that we think knowledge is objective, but only scientific knowledge, not theology, not religion, not the humanities. Postmodernism extends that and says, you know what? There is no truth. Even that is not a truth. It becomes all relative. Truth becomes reducible to power. It's contextualized truth. It's critical theory. It's cultural Marxism, which took on a different dimension, whose primary goal now was to say, how do we infiltrate culture? We don't do it by revolution, by taking over government and military and, you know, law enforcement. We instead go into infiltrate the religions and the education systems. And that's what they've been doing very successfully since that time. So they have launched from this catapult of modernity into postmodernity, and it's as if what happened in the natural sciences created in their laboratories this Frankenstein in the humanities that now I'm seeing in writing, people like Richard Dawkins, people like Peter Boghossian, some of the neo-atheists like that, Steven Pinker from Harvard, all talking about their fear of what's going on in the humanities. You have Jonathan Haidt, who considers himself as a Jewish liberal atheist who wrote The Coddling of the American Mind, who's recently been lecturing across the country, arguing for viewpoint diversity. He has an institute called the Heterodox Academy. Jonathan Haidt said recently at a lecture at Duke that we have two directions now at the universities. Either we are going to focus on social justice universities like Brown University, which has given almost, you know, $100 million toward diversity rather than diversity of viewpoint, diversity of skin color and body parts and things like that, where critical theory tends to divide the world into haves and have-nots, into the victimizers or the victimized, the bourgeois and the proletariat. Or we're going to be truth universities. We either side with Marx or we side with John Stuart Mill. Both of those were atheists, but they represent modernity and postmodernity. And so now we're seeing what's happening radically in the universities at a time when the humanities are engulfed in postmodernism and relativism and the sciences in scientific naturalism. And they're in a fight against one another, but they're both keeping pre-modernist thinkers like Christians at bay on the outside. It's very difficult for us to get in. These were once our universities, but now all we can give to them is our children and the next generation, it seems.
Well, throughout this conversation, I think you've painted kind of a bleak picture for Christianity and the university. And so if I was a parent getting ready to do the whole application process, or my kid is about to go off to the local state university, I would have a lot of grave concerns. So, I mean, it seems so overwhelming. Can anything be done about this current state of affairs at the university, which has turned into quite a hostile place for Christians?
It does seem rather bleak. I mean, we've been in 17 cases of legal proceedings with my organization, Ratio Christi. We've won 2 cases that are federal victories in particular. The other 15, the university's backed down because we've got the Constitution, and that's important. But I think we're facing a cultural onslaught that is fully secularized, and the universities, indeed the education system altogether, because remember, K through 12 educators are now trained from the universities. And so they're secularizing all the way through. It's not encouraging, Melanie. I was in legal proceedings myself as a professor, and I had to bring in Alliance Defending Freedom to help me simply because I wanted to educate and not indoctrinate. And I touched a sacred cow that apparently wasn't okay. You know, if God was not a factor, I would say Europe is going to become Islam, America is going to become Europe, and China may be the future America. I'm depending on God. We're fighting the good fight. We believe in prayer, but we're up against some really, really hard things. From the bottom, the Harvard Crimson Review recently did a survey, and for the first time in its history, this 2019 class has more atheists than agnostics in it among their students than Protestants and Catholics combined. That's the first time ever. Generation Z, which is now in the universities, embraces gay marriage at 73%, and that's a very, very hot topic. A lot of people disbelieve in Christianity because of that topic and the historical viewpoint on that. So from the students on the one hand to the professors on the other hand, where, again, at Brown University as an example, 60-1 ratio across the United States, 23-1 left to right. And if you look at books like Compromising Scholarship by sociology professor George Yancey, almost the very last, the worst identifier you can have if you're interviewing for a job and they ask you is to tell the department head you're an evangelical Christian. It is not a place friendly for Christians, but universities have found ways to get the parents to cleverly pay for the denuding of the faith of their Christian students. We had better wake up. And so my thoughts are threefold. One is that pastors and parents need to realize what is happening in our culture. This is not our grandmother's America anymore. It's a new place. We are not focused on something like Acts chapter 2, where we're going to the synagogues and people believe in God's existence or the Judeo-Christian ethic or the reliability of the Bible. We are in Acts 17. We have been in Mars Hill in a secular post-Christian America for at least a generation. And we need to start realizing that and focusing missions funds on the universities and the education system. We need to start educating our kids with apologetics, with the defense of the faith, because it's now, not only is it a command in Scripture, but it's back in demand. The recent Barna poll says that when they asked non-believers what would most interest you in Christianity, 44% of them said greater evidence for the faith. And yet when they asked Christians that same question, the Christians said they thought non-believers, that was their item that they picked dead last. The church is woefully out of touch with where the world is at, and pastors have some explaining to do on this. Second is that we need to think about campus ministries. Many campus ministries these days are responding or reacting to social fads today, what is happening with social justice in the culture, and that term has both good and bad connotations depending on where you're coming from. It's a real Trojan horse. We need to be careful. And sometimes we're reacting to it rather than responding. And there's a big fear there, but they're not always embracing apologetics evangelism, which is where our new universities are at. It's where our culture is at. We are in Acts 17. We are on Mars Hill. And the non-believers want a plausible, reasonable response to their questions. And then the third one, Melanie, is this. We cannot continue to be on the outskirts of the university like campus ministries or churches. We have got to reclaim the intellectual voice of Christ from the inside out. We have got to, it might be like storming the beaches of Normandy, but we need to push people into careers through graduate school to get PhDs in secular universities. We need to help young doctoral students think carefully about the difference between being a professor who happens to be a Christian and a Christian professor, a missional professor. And then we need to help senior faculty, like full professors and administrators, think about hiring before retiring. We are looking at the greatest changing of the guard in the university in the history of the American university as the baby boomers are retiring. Who will replace them is a fundamentally important question. To not think about the professor, the most important post in the most influential institution of the Western civilization, is, in my mind, the greatest omission of the Great Commission in the Western world. Christians everywhere in the United States need to focus their efforts on the universities and on education. No longer polishing the brass on a sinking ship. We need to think about this as mission critical.
Well, you are mentioning kind of what we should encourage, specifically students, you know, going on to graduate work. But how do they even survive and keep their faith during those critical years as undergraduates so that they can become missional professors? Do you have any tips for parents and students how to really, you know, be able to navigate a university, a place where many professors are going to be hostile to their faith?
Yes, I would encourage people to contact us at ratiochristi.org, ratiochristi.org. We have a high school ministry, RC College Prep. We have a college ministry focused on the undergrads. And then we have a professor ministry. And so we partner with churches. We heavily recruit from our nation's seminaries. We are partnered with the apologetics community, and we have resources for parents, for junior hires, and for high schoolers and so forth, in order to do as 1 Peter 3:15 commands, and that is to be prepared to give an answer, to give a reason for the hope that's in you, and to do it with gentleness and respect. Contact us, and we can give you resources to go from there.
Well, finally, I want to end on a lighter note with some fun rapid-fire questions for Corey. So, Corey, it's summer, and you might be having a cookout to kind of wrap up the summer. Burgers or hot dogs?
Burgers.
We've been talking about the university. So where did you go to college for your undergraduate degree, and what was your major?
Multnomah Bible College for my undergrad, Bible theology.
For a vacation, do you like a vacation away, or are you a staycation person?
Oh, definitely away. I want to see the outdoors, I want to see nature, and I want to see history.
So if you were to go on your ideal vacation and money was no object, where would you like to go?
I just came back from Yellowstone, and that's hard to beat for nature. But the next place I'd love to go is Greece or Rome.
Well, thanks, Corey, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you for having me, Melanie. Love what you guys do. Appreciate it.
Today's guest is Corey Miller, and he has written an online exclusive article for the Christian Research Journal. It's called How We Lost the Universities and How to Reclaim the Voice of Christ. You can read it completely free online at our website, equip.org. And because our website is free and it doesn't require any kind of paywall, we ask that you would consider becoming a subscriber and joining our team of print subscribers. To become a subscriber, please head on over to our website, again, equip.org, and a subscription is $33.50. And we're very grateful for your support of this podcast as well as the Christian Research Journal. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Anagraph, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.